Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and today we're welcoming back to the show a film programmer who has spent decades archiving underappreciated films and sharing their backstories. Elliot Levine, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you so much.
So, Elliot, you've been turning cinemas into classrooms for many years, first in the Bay Area of California and now in Portland.
Yeah, it's been sort of a natural transition from San Francisco to Portland. They seem to have a very similar kind of cinema climate, a great level of appreciation and, you know, interest. Portland to this day probably has the most active cinema landscape of almost any major city. And that includes cities like San Francisco and New York and LA. I mean, it's really up there in a very sophisticated way. There's venues everywhere. San Francisco is shrinking. There's hardly anything really that still exists that was even there 5 years ago or 10 years ago. It's just a shrinking landscape. Portland is such a receptive area for film of all genres, all periods. I mean, look at the Hollywood Cinema 21, Living Room, Clinton Street. I mean, there's so many venues that are really dedicating themselves to, you know, eccentric movie-going experiences. And that's really fantastic. For a transplant like myself, it's great.
Yeah, I keep hearing about these movie houses closing in San Francisco and Berkeley and places like that. I'm wondering if that's the takeover by the private equity people, the real estate people.
That has a lot to do with it. Land there is so valuable. And frankly, theaters just aren't making the kind of money that are going to impel landlords to keep leasing those buildings out to movie theaters if they're going to keep losing money. Berkeley now has, outside of the PFA, Pacific Film Archive, they have no commercial theaters left. None. Berkeley. I mean, it's a college town. And if you want to go to the movies, you got to go to Oakland or San Francisco. It's crazy. It's crazy. And there are fewer venues in those cities. You know, I'm sure people have been reading about the Castro, which is, you know, the historic theater in San Francisco. It's being, well, it's in the process of being taken over by a corporate entity that wants to convert it into a live performance venue, compromising its value as a movie theater. And, you know, it sparked a lot of outrage, but it's like the final stages of the dinosaur age. It's really sad. But Portland's a whole different story. Portland is the way San Francisco was 30 or 40 years ago. And that's a good thing. And I love San Francisco. I miss it, but I don't miss what's happened to the cultural landscape there. It's being devastated.
Well, film noir is kind of your thing, kind of your specialty. You curate an annual festival of sorts called I Wake Up Dreaming. For those of our listeners who may not be the most avid of cinephiles, give us a little bit of a primer about film noir.
Well, film noir, rather than describing it as a genre, it's really sort of a stylization, a cinema stylization that you can apply to a lot of different genres. It could be Westerns that have a film noir feel, science fiction movies, horror movies. Mostly, they're crime movies, cops and robber kind of movies that were really, really popular in the 40s and 50s. But what differentiates these films, the film noirs, are primarily the visualization of it, the way they look and the way they feel. They're dominated by a sense of German expressionism, which is where they kind of sprung from. Thematically, they're dark. They're sort of driven by concepts of fate, inability to escape a present situation, entrapment, those sort of psychological components that differentiated them from the Agatha Christie type of mysteries that were being churned out in Hollywood through the 30s. That changed abruptly, literally, in 1940, when the shift went to something darker and more psychological. It eventually would become known as film noir. That would be a term coined by the French, who picked up on it well before American audiences really were able to kind of put it together themselves. The French dubbed it film noir. In fact, in the mid-40s, say 1946, right after the war, the very first organized film noir festival took place in Paris after the embargo was lifted. So these were all American films that were produced, say, from 1940 through 1945, that had been previously unavailable to French audiences in general, European audiences, because of the embargo. American films just couldn't come over. But there were critics and writers who had traveled to America and seen these films and were eager and anxious to present them in mass to Parisians who were just hungry for this sort of thing, because they really understood that type of film grammar, that dark, psychologically, emotionally drenched stylization of filmmaking that the French understood all too well. And that became film noir. And those films were actually like Phantom Lady and Double Indemnity, all these films that were like from that classic period, 1940 through 1944, 45, Murder, My Sweet, all these great films were being seen all at once by people in France at the same time. So it became a dominant stylization. People talked about it as film noir as early as the 40s and early 50s, but not in this country, really, until much later, until people like Paul Schrader started writing about it in a very mass market sort of sense, like for venues like Film Comment. And they were starting to really kind of throw that term around a lot more loosely. It became, by the mid-70s, early mid-70s, organized film programs in the U.S. were starting to emerge, film noir this, film noir that. It was a slow crawl, but eventually Hollywood, in the big sense, kind of caught up with it in the 80s and really capitalized on that trend and really pushed it into the forefront. That's when the whole big neo-noir explosion took place, and it pushed everything into the forefront, and you began to see it a lot more. And so into the 90s, it became really very commonplace to see film noir everywhere at repertory theaters.
Yeah, well, when you think about what the French went through early in the 40s with all of the occupation and all of the compromises and, you know, not trusting their neighbors necessarily, it makes a lot of sense for French critics like Nino Frank and later Truffaut and Godard to appreciate the sensibility. You know, back in Hollywood, a lot of these films were not considered prestige pictures. They were popular studio films with up-and-coming B-movie actors.
Oh, exactly. They were anything but respectable, and they were almost predominantly B-pictures. In fact, the film that's probably most closely associated with being labeled the first American film noir is an RKO B-picture called Stranger on the Third Floor, which, you know, even the most most casual fans of film noir, they're either going to say, oh, yeah, I've heard of that, but I haven't seen it. Or they're going to just say, I've never heard of that. And that is really kind of the essence of what film noir is about. It's a little bit on the underground side of things. The higher profile films, and most of them are really very enjoyable. You know, films like Double Indemnity and so forth. Big Hollywood productions, even Out of the Past, which kind of straddles, you know, the line of, is it a B movie or is it an A movie? But it blurs it a little bit. And it really, if you begin to study the movies after a while, you say, well, the bigger budget films are compromised. They're compromised by the restrictions that were imposed by the production code. They say, you couldn't talk about this, you couldn't talk about that, couldn't be very sexy. You have to pull back. And the reason those films were more adversely affected by the production code was the very fact that they were big budget movies, and they were the films that were going to appeal to a much wider audience. Unsuspecting young people wandering into the theater didn't necessarily want to be treated with like harsh realities, you know, that would say, wow, people are having sex without, they're not married to these people, and, you know, they're doing horrible things, and it was frowned upon. So those films got watered down a little bit, but it was the B pictures. The films were made a little bit off the radar. Censors weren't really prowling around watching every little move that these B movie directors were trying to pull off. Nobody was examining what Edgar G. Olmer was doing when he made Detour, for example, one of the most subversive American movies ever produced, frankly. It's there a 69-minute Poverty Row B movie, but there were a lot of movies like that, movies that really kind of, in their way, promoted a dark, dark vision of the world, which, if this were happening in a bigger budgeted film in Hollywood at that time, censors would have frowned on those enormously. They would say, do something. Let somebody, you know, be punished, you know, more severely for their transgression. But yeah, of course, those films were playing to a limited, unsophisticated audience, the great unwashed masses of American moviegoers who were flooding these little downtown movie theaters around Poverty Row, Skid Row, you call it what you will, but never to achieve any kind of respect or notoriety until much, much later. You know, those films didn't become canonized until like the 70s, really. People start writing about them as if they were lost masterpieces, which they were. Frankly, they were on the verge of being lost masterpieces.
Yeah, you mentioned the production code, also known as the Hays Code, if I'm getting things right. Yeah. So that was imposed in the 30s. And the new Hollywood movement didn't come around until the 60s. So a lot of people are under the impression that the 1940s and 50s were a very repressed era in cinema. And you're saying that people just had to be a little bit more clever. So there was a lot of, there are a lot of hidden messages. You get science fiction films that had subversive messages, for example, and horror films.
Genre pictures in general.
Yeah.
Whether it's sci-fi or westerns especially, westerns and crime movies were really ripe material for subversive writers and directors to really get their teeth into. You can make them cheaply, make them in black and white, nobody cares if they're in color or not, but the implicit messaging was available to them. So writers like Dalton Trumbo and many, many others who were blacklisted for their subversive relationships with communism, I guess, at the time. They had to go underground, but they were promoting their wonderfully kind of weirdly eccentric socialistic or communistic ideas through genre literature, like Gun Crazy, for example. Gun Crazy is a classic film noir B movie, but Dalton Trumbo wrote it with a certain kind of maniacal edge to it. There's a subversive political edge to that film that once you become aware of who Dalton Trumbo was in relation to this whole business of blacklisting, you say, wow, he's writing about something that's so kind of basic and primal about violence and the casual nature that a relationship that people have with violence, especially gun violence, is very subversive. It might not have seemed all that subversive in 1950, but it really, I screened that recently at the Cinema 21, and people were buzzing about that movie afterwards, but not in a way that you would have thought. They're saying, wow, in a certain sense, that movie was addressing the dangers of unchecked gun violence. And I'm sure that had nothing to do with anything in terms of why that movie was made. I think it was pointing to deficiency within the system that promoted random violence like that. But I think the focus now in 2023 shifts a little bit towards something else. And that's really one of the wonderful qualities about film in general. There's an elasticity to it that kind of adapts. It allows for different interpretations of the same material. It's kind of cool. I mean, it's headed in the same direction, but it's going off in tangents.
You mentioned these programs that you do. Let's talk about some of the different programs that you screen and what the themes tend to be.
Oh, you know, this has turned at Cinema 21 has turned into something I don't think any of the people there at the theater or myself really expected to become as popular as it's become. And because I'm just sort of been a programmer for so long, there's a natural kind of instinct that kind of comes up of linking certain types of films together. If it's just a question of putting, say, four or five Hitchcock films together, that doesn't take a whole lot of thought other than making your selections and hoping that they kind of key into the moment, that this is what people want to see. Initially, the discussion was really at Cinema 21, are people going to want to see Psycho at 11 in the morning? That was an interesting thread of a conversation to have, because really it's something that you have to think about. And I thought, well, you know, the Cinema 21 crowd is becoming really in tune with watching things that are a little bit off center at an early hour of the day, as opposed, I mean, the natural thing, if you're going to see Psycho, it's, 11 at night. No, 11 in the morning. And that, I think, upends a certain concept or a certain proclivity to assume that we can only see certain types of movies at a certain time of the day. The series that we're doing, these are all 11 in the morning screenings, all these films. And some of them are really, really dark. I mean, really dark, but there they are, and people are coming. We had close to 250 people come out and see Vertigo, which is about at 11 in the morning, and it doesn't get a whole lot darker than that. And that's really encouraging to me, that people are readjusting their perceptions of how and when they should see certain types of films. Before you know it, I'm going to be showing Bad Lieutenant and all kinds of things. But we'll see. Maybe not. I don't know.
So these events are all screening on the big screen in theaters. Oh, yeah. And you're back in theaters after a couple of years of the COVID pandemic. How is that working out?
Well, in terms of expectations, the folks at Cinema 21, I mean, I've been connected with those folks ever since moving up here from the Bay Area. I've known Tom, you know, for years. And when the pandemic hit, it really felt like live movie-going experiences was going to be probably forever compromised in one way or another, either for good. I mean, there was a fear factor that I think took hold of people who were in that business of either operating theaters or programming for theaters. It's like, how much are we going to have to rearrange our priorities and how we think about movie going? I was, you know, teaching in-person classes through OSU that were being held at the theaters. Those are ended immediately. And really, frankly, my career as a film instructor, it looked like it was over. But in fact, it became oddly expanded, because the schools that I had previously worked for when I was living in California, like Stanford, suddenly became available to teach for again through Zoom on a regular basis. So, you know, and I've been teaching for Stanford and other California schools via Zoom ever since the pandemic. So from my standpoint, it just kind of rearranged things. And I had to adjust to the fact that I wasn't going to be standing there in a big theatrical setting watching the film, you know, with them. You know, like, you came to some of those classes, I remember. And that was a really kind of a magical thing for a lot of people, to be able to sit there, watch it for 90 minutes and then talk about it in that moment was great. But that kind of came crashing to the ground. But the things that we're doing at Cinema 21 now, it's the closest thing to that. But we're no longer associated with OSU. I mean, we're just doing it as a more of a commercial theatrical venue. It gives us access to the highest quality presentation. We wouldn't be able to access the DCPs doing it any other way. And I really do want the experience to be, you know, the best it can possibly be under the circumstances. And in this instance, it would be screening in DCP.
That's digital cinema package.
Exactly. I mean, that's what you look at when you go see Avatar or any contemporary film. You're looking at a DCP.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking today with film programmer Elliot Levine. You know, one of the things that happened in the first weeks and months of the pandemic in 2020, when people were locked down, was everybody went to watch movies on the streaming services like Netflix and Amazon Prime. The problem there is, if you're looking for movies, made before 1980, you'll only find a handful, maybe a few dozen on the streaming services.
Well, you know, I have had to force myself because so many of my classes now involve films that were made before 1980, most of them, in fact. And they're all available. They're all available to stream, but you have to really search for them. You really, and it may not be belonging to the particular platform that you have subscription to. So it just, you have to kind of figure out, who offers me the most? Is it Paramount Plus? Well, tons of old films. Is it, well, there's lots of them. You know,
well, there's Canopy, which is through libraries.
Your library, that's an amazing resource. Internet Archive is a great resource for people who don't mind watching films on their computer screen and not, you know, being able to hook them up to something bigger. But there's lots of alternatives. Even on YouTube, for God's sake, you could build a library of high quality YouTube links that you can kind of share with your friends and have your own little film festivals. They're out there. You got to work at it, though. You got to really look.
And in the Pacific Northwest, people have a bit of a love affair with physical media.
They do.
You can still rent DVDs and even VHS tapes at places like Scarecrow Video in Seattle, Movie Madness in Portland. And in Bend, the last remaining Blockbuster outlet.
It almost seems funny. Who works there? Some young genius that we'll hear about 10 years. Well, it's you know, I hate to view it as a dying subculture, but it kind of is. And it's kind of refreshing to see some people kind of clinging to it, you know, or just able to and doing it successfully. You know, it's not going to happen in a widespread way, although you never know. Look what happened to vinyl. Vinyl made a nice comeback, so, you know, at least in a kind of a marginalized sense of the word, but enough, you know, to keep it afloat. VHS, I don't know. I mean, I believe it or not, I still have about 40 or 50 VHS tapes that I just haven't been able to separate myself and throw them away. They're useless to me, I'm sure, because my VHS player died years ago and I never really thought to find a new one, although they're out there. You can find them all everywhere. So who knows?
Speaking of formats that are endangered, there are fewer and fewer cinemas in Portland that still show 35 millimeter films. There's the Hollywood, the Academy, maybe the Clinton Street and the Film Center. How about Cinema 21? Are there 35 millimeter?
It's funny, when I first arrived here in 2017, we did a film noir festival there. And I guess it was the spring of 2017, and it was 100% in 35, all studio prints. And it was pretty impressive to see it that way. It was a huge burden on the theater because, I mean, it just is. I mean, you know, it's just not easy, especially if you're not accustomed to doing it as a theater.
Big, heavy cans of reels.
Huge, heavy can. I mean, it costs a fortune, especially if you're doing a festival. It's just your shipping fees alone are going to kill you. And, you know, certainly not every screening is going to do as well as maybe another one a little bit down the line, say a few days later. But you're going to have to absorb that loss. And it's an expensive loss if you're playing a film one time. And it weighs like 9,000 pounds and you got to get it out there the next day because it's got to be in Chicago the next day. So you got to send it overnight, which is going to like double or triple your shipping. It's a nightmare. Frankly, it is a nightmare to deal with it. Plus, there is the added aggravation. And this is sort of the unknown bugaboo about all of this, of all 35 projection. You can't really count on the print really being to the standards that you would hope or expect it to be. So often they look like crap. Very often, if it's a studio print of a famous popular film, you're looking at a composite print, which is basically, you know, I mean, it's been constructed from the best reels of whatever's available. And so light levels are going to be different. If you're looking at a film noir, it's maddening because it's going to look like gray for like 20 minutes and all of a sudden it's going to be high contrast. It's really distracting and it's awful. And they look chewed up sometimes. And, you know, studios should be slapped on the wrist, actually, for letting prints like that out. But yet that is part and parcel to the problem, unless you're a theater that's dedicated, really dedicated to doing 35. Let's say the Hollywood is pretty much dedicated to do it whenever they can, whenever it's available. So they probably have, maybe they have a better access to certain, you know, vault prints or studio prints that are locked up for, you know, certain venues. Kind of hard to say with respect to Cinema 21. So their 35 has been dormant, but this is really kind of exciting, and I'm glad you brought it up. But I was talking with Tom Raniere just that last week, and they are going to bring their 35 back for special screenings, for, you know, whatever it may be. Somebody wants to rent the theater, or if there's a special screening that a studio wants to put together, Cinema 21 will now be able to do that. And I can now announce to you on your program something that I haven't really talked about with anybody else, but at Cinema 21 in early May, we're going to have a 35 millimeter screening of the 1999 neo-noir film, The Woman Chaser, with Patrick Warburton. Rob DeVore directed the film. It originally played in Portland in 1999 at the Cinema 21. And it's being restored, and it's being presented in a beautiful 35 print. The star, Patrick Warburton, will be at the theater that night. It's going to be Wednesday, May 3rd, something to kind of look forward to, you know, down the line. But yeah, it is important because what that means is Cinema 21 will once again be a player in that realm of 35 projection. So there can be those occasions when you really want to play something in 35, they'll be able to do it. So that's really great. Very excited about that.
So yeah, people have their opinions, and social media is, of course, a place to go if you want to get enraged. There was this one, I can't remember who it was now. He was this big name culture writer for some magazine, and he said that he will not watch any movie made before the year 2000. And he got absolutely dragged. You know, he said there every movie made before 2000 is just boring and unwatchable.
Well, that's why he said it. He said it to generate a response. So when people fall into that trap, they have nobody to blame but themselves. You know, anybody, I mean, that is a statement that's designed to create a flap. And, you know, and if you're desperate for that kind of attention, if you need thousands of people responding to that, well, that's a good way to go. It's a pointless way to go, but it's a good way to go, I guess.
But then again, I was on a thread with people that I thought really liked film, and they were asking, what's the best version of Robin Hood? And I said, oh, you know, the 1930s one with Errol Flynn. You know, you can just see the cast all had worked together before. They all had this bonhomie. They had a great time working together. It was just so damn much fun. And everybody's like, no, that's so boring. And I'm just like, what are you talking about?
The key there is using the words best or worst. You should eliminate that from any discussion. You can, and you can obviate that whole problem by saying, well, I don't know about the best, but my favorite version would be the Errol Flynn version. And that kind of reduces the temperature a little bit, because their own views aren't being challenged necessarily. They're being augmented by somebody else's opinion, which may not be the same. But at the same time, you're not challenging his decision. Well, no, I think Kevin Costner version kicks ass. And and that's the way it is. And try to change my mind, motherfucker. You can't do it. So yeah, of course. But I think if you approach it, I hate the whole best, worst thing. Whenever it enters into a conversation about movies, I vacate myself. I go into another room and get myself a cocktail. I'm just not going to participate in that, because it's an open invitation to strife and to acrimony. And it's just, you can't deal with best and worst in a subjective arena like movies. You just can't do it. I mean, you can, but at your own peril. And I just would never jump into something like that. It's awful. I mean, I've seen, you know, friendships end over things as silly as that. I can see friendships ending over political differences, but certainly not movies.
So you mentioned neo-noir earlier, and some people say that the noir revival kind of started in the 1970s with Chinatown, the Roman Polanski film with Jack Nicholson. But it really kind of took off in the 1980s, 1990s with John Dahl and David Lynch and the Coen brothers.
And Body Heat, however we may feel about that film aesthetically, it was really instrumental in getting people interested in film noir, just because of the overt associations that it created. It was done intentionally to pay homage to that particular style of filmmaking. I showed that film recently in a film class on neo-noir films. And surprisingly, and I was really surprised, I chose that film in what I thought would be an example of something that turned into something kind of facile and not all that stimulating. But it wound up being one of the most popular films of the entire quarter because it struck a chord with the passage of time. The film is now 40 years old. And at the time, it was parodying, or at least paying tribute to films that were then 40 years old. So it placed itself in a kind of interesting paradigm. It's kind of like now it's become a product of the very thing that it was trying to pay homage to. And I think people had an opportunity to see it in that vein. And it even gave me an opportunity. I didn't like that movie when it came out in 1983 or whatever, but I really enjoyed watching it this time around. It had a whole different feel, and you know, it didn't seem all that self-conscious to me. It didn't seem like it was trying to intentionally draw my attention to that self-conscious quality that the film, to me, you know, spoke to when I first watched it 40 years ago. So, oh, he's showing off. He just wants to show us how much he knows about film noir. Or, all right, I get it. This, he's supposed to be like Fred McMurray in Double Indemnity. He's a good-natured, stupid guy, and he's going to do all the wrong things, and he's going to wind up in a death trap. And that's how it works. And like, it seemed really obvious and not that interesting. But now, with the passage of 40 years or so, it did. It seemed like a film of its time, you know, or a film of an earlier time, maybe even. I felt less bothered by it. And that was kind of a pleasant surprise. But I think that was the film that I think, in a broad sense, yeah, Chinatown and Long Goodbye a decade earlier, those were films that were jump starters. They made people aware of it, but it didn't make them card-carrying followers necessarily, the way the early 80s film. Another one was Against All Odds, which I think came out around the same time, which was essentially a remake of Out of the Past with James Woods and Jeff Bridges. So that was happening around the same time. And again, that was giving writers and magazine writers an opportunity to call in all of the bullshit that they learned in, you know, the prior several, reading Paul Schrader's articles and just studying the stuff on their own and creating a well of reference points that they could now talk about these contemporary films with some so-called intellectual framework, things they could pin it on and say, oh yeah, it's a lot like this Billy Wilder film from 1944 or this or that or whatever. It gave their writing a certain ring of authority.
You directed a couple of neo-noir films back in the 1980s, short films. One of them is called The Twisted Corridor. It can be found on YouTube.
And Blind Alley was the first one. Yeah, I mean, that, I was infected with the whole film noir movement at the time. This when these projects began in the mid-70s when I first moved out to San Francisco from Detroit. So those were that was the style that I gravitated to when I went to film school, and that was the result. But they were fun to do, even though they took a toll. When you dive into that dark, dark pool, hoping to contribute even something on a small level, like a short film, a student film, you want to marry up to it as closely as you can, because you're younger and you're kind of dedicated to the idea of being an artist. And you want to get as sad as the material will allow you. Because if you're getting this close to this kind of material, and if you're with it for several years, I mean, these two films took like several years to deal with, I mean, on a constant basis. And they're dark, dark themed stories with dark images. And yeah, it's going to have an effect. You got to crawl out of it. You got to say, oh boy, I'm normal again. And it's going to take a couple years maybe to like break that spell. But I have no regrets. I really love those little movies. I love the experience of making them. It really prepared me I think more than anything, for life and programming and teaching film, and teaching about film, not how to make them, but just how to look at them maybe in a certain way.
Well, it seems like people are finally back in theaters after...
We're corralling them. We're getting them in there.
After a long time away. And you have some programs coming up.
Well, we're just finishing a four-week series of Audrey Hepburn films. We have one more to go next Saturday, this coming Saturday, the 25th, with our screening of Breakfast at Tiffany's. We'll try to avoid talking about Mickey Rooney. It's just something we have to live with. But following that, for the month of March, there are four Saturday mornings in March. So those will be devoted to four films by Billy Wilder. So we'll be looking at Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, The Apartment, and we'll close it out with Some Like It Hot, almost inarguably four of his most popular pictures. And again, on the big screen, they really do have a pretty strong impact, especially Sunset Boulevard. Why should I say especially all of them? They're all very strong films and will probably do nicely. April is even more exciting in a lot of ways because it has five Saturdays. I can expand the whole nature of it, not necessarily focus on one personality. So April is going to be five films from the 50s. And these are not just normal 50s films. In some ways, they're either iconically interesting for one reason or another, or kind of subversively strange or cultish in some fashion. But we'll be starting that with On the Waterfront, the Brando picture, followed by 12 Angry Men. Again, another Kazan film, A Face in the Crowd. Then the real wild card in this particular deck, which of course is Nicholas Ray's Freudian Western classic, Johnny Guitar. And we'll close it out at the end of the month with Don Siegel's mind-blowing film, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So these are all films that really kind of project kind of a distinct and interesting look at life in the 50s, whether we like to think about it or not. So that's coming up. We've got Billy Wilder in March and five from the 50s in April.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we've been talking today with film programmer Elliot Levine. Elliot, thanks for joining us.
Conch, it's been a pleasure. Always a great pleasure to check in with you. Thank you so much.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your programming, where would they look?
Our best place to look, well, they can Google me. They'll get some things there, my name, just toss it into your server. Or they can go to the Cinema 21 website, cinema21.com, and look in their coming soon link, and you'll find all these films, at least casually mentioned, with showtimes and dates and all that sort of thing.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.